Du lytter til Hestedølærerne. Podcasten for dig, der er dølæge eller veterinærsygeplejerske og arbejder med heste. Mit navn er Emma Thomsen. Jeg er dølæge og arbejder som konsulent for Boehringer Ingelheim. I Hestedølærerne taler vi om tilstanden og sygdommen, der kan ramme heste, men vi tager også andre emner op, som er relevante for dig, der arbejder med hestesundhed. Denne podcast er lavet af Boehringer Ingelheim, og med denne podcast ønsker vi at give noget tilbage til dig, der arbejder med hestesundhed. Vi ønsker at tage emner op, som er interessante og relevante for dig, og hvis du har forslag til emner, du gerne vil høre mere om, eller tips til en gæst, du gerne vil høre, så tøv ikke med at kontakte os. Mine kontaktoplysninger finder du i podcastens beskrivelse.
Welcome to the third episode where we talk about nutrition and clinical nutrition with Ingrid Verfurt from the University of Leipzig. Ingrid is a nutritionist and veterinarian, and we are discussing these topics with her as she is an expert on this subject. And this episode we wanted to devote to nutritional supplements because there are a lot of supplements out there. And one is being marketed as better than the other. There's no limit to what marketeers can say about supplement products. But what we want to ask Ingrid today is what she thinks, that is there actually something that has any value, and if something actually works, and then which those are. And we are also going to dive in a little bit deeper on specific supplements that you as a veterinarian out there in the field can get questions about from horse owners. So first of all, welcome back to the podcast, Ingrid.
Thank you very much for the introduction. And yeah, I'm looking forward for this very interesting talk we will have.
So do we. So let's just start with a really like brief or overview question. When it comes to nutritional supplements and herbs, what does actually work, or is there anything that actually works, and how does it work?
We have huge amounts of different supplements on the market. On the one hand, it could be vitamins such as vitamin E. It could be also trace elements like zinc, for example, to improve skin disorders. And we have other supplements, which is probably just a single feed, like linseed meal. And I claim that the omega-3 fatty acids may have some positive effects on health. And we have also a huge amount, like, for example, joint supplements or supplements which may improve the hoof health, or supplements which may have an effect of digestive disorders such as stomach ulcer or diarrhea or free fecal water.
As you say, I mean, there is a lot of things out there, and there are also a lot of claims being made by producers. And we wanted to ask you a little bit about legislation, because there are rules about how you can market products and what you can claim. And it's also... there are also rules regarding the labeling and so on with the product. So what do you have to say about that? Because, I mean, we do see a lot of claims that might not be allowed. But how big of a concern do you think that is? And what can you tell us about legislation? What can and can you not say about the supplement?
Mm-hmm. We have, I think, two different type of supplements according legislation. On the one hand, we have supplements that just contain single feed, like linseed meal, like herbs, for example. And these are single feed, and there is no clear legislation. They are classified as a single feed. Maybe as an example, the herbs, from the legislation, they belong to the forages, and they can be dried and supplement in different ways. And all these feeds which belong to the single feed from legislation, there are no studies which have probably improve or shown that there are some health effects. There can be some studies, but it's not necessary because from legislation, they are used as single feeds. But the main point is that you are not allowed to do any health claims when you use a single feed because they are natural feeds, let's say like forages or like linseed meal. Of course, you can horse feed producer can say, okay, I have a supplement which contains high levels of omega-3 fatty acids by using linseed meal or linseed oil or hemp oil or whatever. That is okay, but it is not allowed to say when you add these linseed meal or the omega-3 fatty acids, then you will improve joint disorders or stomach ulcer. That is, so the health claim is not allowed when you use single feed. And then we have another large group which are used in supplements. These are the so-called additives. And for example, the vitamins or the trace elements, they all belong to the additives. Or for example, probiotics, there are one or there are some species which are allowed and they are claimed as additive. For example, for in horses, it's just the Saccharomyces cerevisiae species. When they are claimed as or when they are listed up as an additive, then there are several points which has to be considered. For example, the company, they have to claim the exact amounts of the feed additive. For example, for the zinc, it has be or it must be labeled that, for example, the amount of zinc, let's say 1,000 milligram per kilogram, and it's also it must be labeled which type of zinc is used in the supplement, for example, zinc oxide. So there must be a very clear definition of the additive which is included in the supplement. So I think that is, we have these two different kind of supplements. On the one hand, they use single feed like herbs or linseed meal or whatever. And then we find a lot of supplements, they use additives which are clearly defined how they have to use the additives. So I think these are the main points. And then we have maybe a third type of supplements they use additives, or not, they use supplements which are probably not allowed in the European Union because maybe they come from the US because the legislation is completely different in the US, and they use additives which are not listed up as additives in the European Union. For example, the probiotics which come from the US, they are allowed to use different strains, for example, lactobacillus, enterococci, but these species, or this bacterial species, are not allowed in supplements in the European Union because these type of bacteria are not listed up as an additive. So, but we know these products, but they in a way are not legal.
Okay, that's interesting. How do you find out if something is listed as an additive? I mean, there must be a database or something where you can go search or...
Yes, you can just point out or put in additive European Union, and then you find a very good detailed report which type of additives are allowed. Honestly, for the most European feed companies, the companies are really aware about what is allowed and what is not allowed. I do a lot of checking of the labeling, and I can't find really many mistakes. So most of the companies, they know that they have to label, for example, zinc, and they had to use this zinc, which is allowed as an additive, and they put the exact amount. And when these supplements are analyzed, if they are correct labeled and is really zinc in the product, we don't find too many problems. So from this point, it is quite okay. I think the most problematic point is that those companies who use single feed, like herbs or whatever, or linseed meal, because I have an actual an case, because the feed company used linseed meal and they claimed a lot of health issues. And so it's probably more the single feed which produce the most problems, because there are a lot of health claims which are not allowed. And in the moment, a lot of the administration start to regulate much more these products on the market. So you find the labeling, and if you do not find any proper labeling, let's say for the vitamins or for the trace elements, and there's no information which type of zinc or which type of trace element is used, and there's no clear information about the amounts which are included, and no feeding recommendation. If you can't find this on the labeling, you shouldn't use the supplement. Maybe another point is that if you use supplements which are illegal, maybe they come from outside from the European Union, you also have to think it could be also doping relevant. Mm-hmm. So that is also an issue of concern. That is also an issue of concern when you use different types of herbs in a supplement, some or have substances which are doping positive, and therefore you must be really aware what you are feeding.
I'm actually quite surprised to learn that such a thing as herbs can be considered a single feed, or with not as strict legislation around it, because I mean, herbs can contain active substances that can actually do stuff, and then it should be probably a little bit stricter what you put on the bucket, but
yeah, I think the herbs, this is really a big problem, because they are kind of forages, and there's no, or in many cases, no scientific evidence behind it. Another point is that the feed company, they mix different types of herbs, mixed it, and sometimes you do not know about the exact levels which are used. And when you look to Chinese traditional medicines, they use in that way one or two herbs, but we have a lot of a big mixture of different types of herbs, and they either, on the one hand, they contain the active substances, and maybe it's also possible if you use different types of herbs in one supplement and you don't have any data about it, that these substances may have negative consequences. One active substance may have a negative consequence on the other active substance. Yeah. So there's a lot of interaction, and therefore it is, I think, especially the herbs, it is a very problematic topic. So because we don't know too much, and I think it's really surprising that they are kept as forages. And yeah.
So when you have owners coming and really pushing for recommendation for herb supplementation, what should you tell them in layman terms regarding this advice?
I mean, I think it's maybe just would there's a good slogan from the FEI. They say, if in any doubt, do not give it to your horse. And I think that is a very good recommendation. And beside from the doping issue, I would like to explain it with an example. For example, many veterinarians, they use the milk system in horses who suffer under high liver enzyme activities. When you go into the scientific literature, you find, let's say, 8 to 9 different papers about the milk system used in horses, but only 2 papers described or had a model where they looked to liver metabolism in horses. And when you go to these 2 papers, in that 2 papers, they fed milk system and artichoke to the horses. And interestingly, the gamma GT levels, which is a typical liver enzyme, were higher after feeding the milk system in combination with the artichoke before feeding. So we must be always aware that we have low scientific evidence according to herbs, and we must be aware that they may have negative consequences on health. And therefore, I think the slogan from the FEA is very good: if in any doubt, do not give it to your horse. And we don't have really scientific evidence with herbs, then you shouldn't feed it. I mean, one point I can really understand is that a complementary feed, when it is enriched with different types of herbs, the palatability is quite high. So that could be for me an argument if you have a horse with a low appetite, etc., and then you include some herbs that you can increase the feed intake, then it's fine for me. But you shouldn't expect too many health effects when you use supplements which contain herbs, for example. Mm.
And I guess one of the things about the herbs is that it's extrapolated from what we know from humans. So the addition of herbs and the effect of herbs is extrapolated from humans in many cases. And we are trying to put it back on horses, and maybe where horses are not having the same effect, the different enzymatic processes, diseases and all that stuff. So extrapolating directly from what we know in humans could be efficient, might not be exactly the same in horses. What are your thoughts about that? Everything is coming from the human literature and extrapolated into horses, or?
I totally agree. That is one point. But another point is that a lot of studies, especially in herbs, has been done in vitro systems. Mm. And then it's getting much more difficult to extrapolate from in vitro systems into the horse or even into humans. So, of course, in human medicine, we have some other types of herbs, which are kind, they are not as food or single food. They are claimed as medical herbs, but this is a third type of legislation, medical herbs. And we don't have this claiming in horses because most companies use it as a single feed. And most companies are not so interested to use it as medical herbs because then there are legislation is completely different, and then it's not allowed to use all, huge amounts of different herbs without knowing really the specific nutrients and active substances in a complementary feed. So for humans, we have a third type of legislation, which of course we can use medical herbs also in horses, but again, your argument is completely right. That is a lot of extrapolated from humans or from in vitro system in the body, and that's probably not valid. Yeah,
I think this milk thistle example is really interesting because then you're saying that the two studies that actually are worth something or that measure liver enzymes, they showed an increase or yes. A negative effect. But where does the idea then come from that it would have any beneficial effect to start with?
Mm-hmm. It comes from the in vitro studies. So they yeah. used different types of in vitro study. And then, of course, you see some, let's say, protective effects, increase oxidative capacity in the yeah. cell, etc. So that is the extrapolation. And, of course, we have some studies beside hepatoprotective effects in horses. They used, for example, the zilibinin, which is the active substance or one of the active substance in the milk thistle. And they used, for example, the zilibinin or the milk thistle in healthy horses to increase antioxidative capacity. And when you go through the paper, you couldn't find any positive effect of adding zilibinin to improve antioxidative capacity. So we have at least some studies, at least for the milk thistle in healthy horses, and they couldn't find any positive effects. So we also should be aware that these studies are not very specific for liver metabolism, but of course it could be, or there is some information on the antioxidative capacity. And when you couldn't find any positive effects in healthy horses, and that is always the way that you start first to test the substance in healthy horses, and then you look, are there any positive or negative effects? Because we have always to think about negative effects, and then you go into horses, for example, with liver damage. But when we can't either find in healthy horses any positive effects, and you can find any positive effects in horses with liver problems, then probably milk thistle is not the best way to feed to our horses.
And I guess this is one of the examples where you're always as a veterinarian trying to do no harm. And if what you're saying is valid, then some of these feed supplements are actually not a do no harm category. You can do harm if you're
very unlucky. Yep.
Yeah, and I think it's also really important point that, I mean, if there are only two studies with beneficial results for a product, the marketing around it will concentrate on those positive results. And maybe then you have to take a closer look. But what kind of study was it actually? Because what you're saying with the in vitro studies, that's a super good example of that something looks really good in the lab, but out there in reality, we have a different effect or a different result. And I think it's easy, both as a horse owner and maybe as a vet being asked about these, to sort of get lost in this. And that, you know, when faced with, yeah, but there are studies that show benefit, then you have to think one more step, you know, what kind of studies are those? And are they really valid in this specific real case? You know, I think it's a super important point.
I mean, I can understand either the veterinarians and also the horse owners, because they want to do the best for their horse.
Yeah.
And when all the products are claimed, they are super healthy or they can improve health, then of course it's I can understand this point. And therefore, I think it's not just, we should not just address it to the veterinarians, take care and think about scientific studies, because they are very busy the whole day and they have no possibility to look all into the scientific stuff. But honestly, I think also the feed companies should be more aware that not all of the products are really the best what they can do for the horse. And because we have, I don't know, thousands and thousands of different supplements, and it would be very good if the feed companies also rethink what are we doing? Are we doing, or do we really produce healthy supplements? Because again, for when we look to increased liver enzyme activities and herbs, at least in human safety, there is some concern that different herb products may contain higher pyrrolizidine alkaloids, the pH, which has a negative effect on liver metabolism. And for example, in herb supplements, when they are used for humans, for example, there is an upper safe limit of the pyrrolizidine alkaloids, because we know that they are frequently contaminated. So also we have to consider that. And interestingly, for feedstuff for animals, we don't have this upper safe limits for pyrrolizidine alkaloids. It's just for human foods, and there was a lot of pressure from the different companies, the stakeholders, not to use such a benchmark for the pyrrolizidine alkaloids, because they have to analyze it frequently and to make sure that they are below this limit. But again, for horse feed, for example, we don't have this restriction. So we must make sure that especially the herbs may have also negative substances like the pyrrolizidine alkaloids. Mm. So that's another issue.
Yeah, very important point. When it comes to then substances that might be of benefit, what are, in your opinion, the most interesting substances that are being marketed today, or that is out there and sold commercially?
In what way do you mean interesting? Is it what these supplements which are frequently used, or the supplements I would recommend? That is probably
let's do the ones that you would recommend, or maybe it could also be if you think that there is a substance that have potential for something like in the future, you know. But which do you think are the most interesting and good?
I think the most interesting for me are the omega-3 fatty acids, because we have at least some studies also in horses. And we know that the omega-3 fatty acids are absorbed, and they are, for example, also integrated in the cell, etc. And we also know the mechanism behind the omega-3 fatty acids. Therefore, I think this is a very interesting group, and I think there's a lot of potential, and I think it's there's increasing interest in the omega-3 fatty acids. We also use the products from fish, etc., and also from the linseed meal. So this is, for me, a very interesting substance. Also the vitamin E, which is also an additive. It's a nutrient. And we have a recommendation about the amounts horses should give in on a daily basis. But it's also, for me, because the vitamin E has maybe certain health issue, effects on antioxidative capacity, on muscle function, etc., on immune function. So the vitamin E could be, or isn't, for me, an interesting product. And maybe also the castorberry preparation, which you can, or there at least two studies, they have shown that they may have a positive impact on the ACTH levels. So in the Cushing horses, it may have a positive effect, but I always recommend to have a combination with the pergolite, for example, the Prasand, in combination with the castorberry preparation, but not just alone the castorberry preparation. So there could be some support, or there could be an improvement in the endocrine control. So that is also, for me, an interesting additive. Otherwise, honestly, I would like to spend most studies, most effort to improve forage quality. But omega-3 fatty acids, so I think they have some potential. Yeah.
And can I ask, Ingrid, the sources from where you get the omega-3 fatty acids, are there any differences between the sources where the fatty acids come from?
There's little information that probably when the omega-3 fatty acids come from fish oil or marine products, it could be that the utilization is somewhat better, because from the linseed products, there must be a kind of conversion step. Could be limited in horses, but we are not very clear about that. So it could be that the marine products may have some more beneficial effects, but still this needs much more scientific data. But there is some evidence. But again, I still recommend linseed meal or linseed oil. But there's some research going on. It could be that we come to the conclusion that the marine products may have some better health effects.
And as far as I know, most of the equine products will be of non-fish oil. That would be more linseed, and more of the other types would be marketed for dogs and cats and whatnot, right?
Yeah, but when we, for example, come to fish oil, for example, it is allowed, although it's a product from animals. So it's always, this discussion is also a point, but it's allowed to feed fish oil to horses. And interestingly, we also did a study about the palatability about fish oil and linseed oil and rapeseed oil and sunflower oil. And at least our research horses prefer the fish oil, although the smell for us is not that nice, but at least our horses, and we had 10 horses and we never published it, but it's interesting to see from the palatability. And we know, for example, from Icelandic horses in Iceland, sometimes they feed fish to their horses. And I was always wondering, but maybe Icelandic horses are somewhat different to other horses, but they seem to prefer the fish, the herring. But it could be because the herring, it's come from the sea, and it could be a little bit salty, and it could be maybe the effect that there was a sodium deficiency and therefore they prefer the salt fish. I don't know. It's just by a veterinarian, she told me. So I don't have clear data about it. But anyway, in our research horses, they prefer the fish oil.
Interesting.
Another substance which could be of interest is the gamma oritanol. The gamma oritanol, it's in rice bran and in rice oil. At least we have one or two studies again, it is an in vitro study, but they use the muscle cell from a horse and they incubated the muscle cells with the omega retinol, and they could see that the protein or those genes and those enzymes which are responsible for muscle or to increase muscle mass, that they are triggered by the gamma retinol. But again, it's just an in vitro study, but for me that is also quite interesting substance.
Interesting. And I guess the next question sort of relates to this one then, because it's a question about the science behind it. And we've been talking a little bit about the different kind of studies and what you should be looking for. But are there any supplements that you find that have like the most robust evidence behind it, or at least the least bad evidence, or how to say it? Like, what are those, the most researched substances?
I think we have different substances, and there's always some research around these substances. Maybe I think most supplements I found, at least in those questions I got from the horse owners, is those substances which buffer the gastric juice or the gastric acid. So all kinds of buffering substances like magnesium, like calcium, aluminium, silicates, etc. There is some research going on about these supplements, and we see that those supplements which are intended to buffer the gastric juice and to increase the pH in the stomach, that there is a mechanism behind it. So you can increase the gastric pH by using these buffering substances. But when you look to the dosage, you have to feed them, let's say, every 3 or 4 hours to have a constant increase in the pH in the stomach, and therefore they may have some potential, but in the way they are used today, let's say 25 gram in the morning and 25 gram in the evening, that is not really effective to have a constant increase in the gastric pH. So there is some potential about that. Then it's also a lot of debate in what way supplements may influence the insulin response. So yeah, there's also one or two studies, they look to the omega-3 fatty acids, in which way they may have an impact on insulin dysregulation. But today I would say that they are not that effective. So again, management factors are much more necessary to reduce starch and sugar intake than using these supplements to improve insulin regulation. So yeah. The joint supplements, there's some research going on about the joint supplements, and a lot of people use this joint supplements. But again, the scientific evidence is quite low, because when you look to the joint supplements, they use, let's say, glucosamine, chondroitin sulfate, or the green-lipped mussel. These are really large molecules, and it is always very difficult to understand are they really able, or we know from the data, are they really able to enter the intestine, and that they will be increased in the joint? So there is some research going on, but they are not, or most of the study are not so convincing that we should use these joint supplements. And there's little research going on about the hoof supplements. Mm-hmm. There are some data about biotin, and actually they show that some horses may have a low biotin production by the microflora, and the biotin may have some positive effects on the hoof horn quality. But today we are missing studies about adding sulfur-containing amino acids to improve hoof horn quality, because the sulfur-containing amino acids are quite essential for the stability of the hoof horn. So that would be, for me, a great wish to do a little bit more research in hoof supplements, but focus a little bit more not on zinc or biotin, focus a little bit more on the sulfur-containing amino acids, because there seem to be a mechanism which could be helpful to improve hoof horn quality.
I've noticed a trend in horse owner circles that it's popular to give sulfur or MSM, and they also talk about it in context of laminitis and whatnot. What do you have to say about that?
That's also MSM. I nearly stood in all the rations, and I'm always wondering, because the scientific evidence is quite low. We don't have data in laminitic horses. We don't have data to improve hoof horn quality. The only and sometimes they say they need the MSM to improve the availability of other trace elements. We don't have any data about that. Again, it comes from in vitro study. It comes from, at least in part, from human study, and we don't have really clear scientific evidence that we really have to add MSM. But actually, MSM could be an interesting substance when we look really to the tissues which may need, for example, sulfur. It could be an interesting substance for the future, but data are missing.
So what about the gastrointestinal supplements, and specifically then those marketed towards hindgut? Because there are lots of products out there that claim to be probiotic, prebiotic. There are other fancy words with the word biotic in them. What are your opinion on those?
Maybe we must make clear what are probiotics. These are the living microorganisms, and prebiotics. They provide substances that good bacteria may have an advantage to survive in the large intestine. But when we look to the probiotics, it's for me extremely important to underline that in the European Union, only the Saccharomyces cerevisiae species, there are different strains, are allowed. Other probiotic strains like Lactobacillus, Enterococcus, etc. are not allowed as a supplement in horses. And that is really, we must be aware about this fact. So if you find in a product Lactobacillus, they may use it as a feed additive to produce a proper silage. But we must make clearer, it's completely different to produce a silage, because you want to decrease the pH in the silage as fast as possible to get stable conditions. But in the large intestine, in most cases, we don't want to decrease the pH, because it's a negative point, because a lot of horses who suffer from diarrhea have acidosis. And when you put Lactobacillus strains in the large intestine, they use sugars, etc., and they produce much more lactate in the large intestine, which is negative. So we must make sure about the mechanism. And so I'm not very happy using Lactobacillus in horses as a probiotic strain, and it's not allowed. And we have at least some data in foals when Lactobacillus species are edited in a probiotic supplement, that the episode of diarrhea is getting worse. So it's not positive, it is negative. So when we look to the Saccharomyces cerevisiae strains, there's some research going on. Most research has been done in France, and honestly, yes, they found one or two positive things. They found, for example, that one bacterial strain is increased or decreased among 100,000 other bacterial strains. So because when we look to at least to the lactobacilli do not really belong in huge amount to the natural microflora. And I'm not convinced from these data that any positive effect, because they just looked to one or two to the strain, the bacterial strains, and they found some changes, but it has no outcome on health. And there's another study. They had Saccharomyces cerevisiae, and they found a positive effect in the IgG, the antibodies against bacteria, etc., in foals after supplementation to one time point. So they collected a lot of blood samples and did a good overview what happened after the intake of Saccharomyces on the IgG levels. And to one time point, the IgG levels were somewhat higher by adding the Saccharomyces cerevisiae. But they looked, let's say, for 4 or 5 days, and only 12 hours after supplementation, there was a significant positive effect on a higher IgG levels, but not before and not after. So my concern is that yes, that can happen, but it's not an overall effect. So yes, there are studies about Saccharomyces cerevisiae. It depends a little bit on the research group who published the data. Those who are completely independent, they couldn't find really clear effects, sometimes yes, an increase, sometimes not. And those who are somewhat more supported from companies, they interestingly came sometimes to a different conclusion. And it should be also pointed out, I forgot this point, that it is sometimes very difficult to publish results who couldn't find anything by the supplements. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it's very difficult to publish these studies. And those who find a positive effect, of course your conclusion is much easier to understand and it's easy going. So these paper or these data are much more easier to publish than let's say negative effect. So so that we should also consider that when we found a lot of paper and they found some positive effects, that also some companies are very strict how data are published. Yeah. I have also, or a company, they asked me to do a study, and they said, when you have positive effects, yes, of course you can publish and you can do a PhD thesis and we'll pay for it. But in case of negative results or you couldn't find any effect, then we are not very interesting to publish. So we also should consider this point.
Yeah. Regarding the Saccharomyces, there is another one that's called Bulardii, but I guess it's not registered in the EU as a... What's your opinion on that one?
Yes. First, to emphasize, it's not allowed as a feed additive in the European Union. And the point is that we have most data, again, from human medicine. And yes, it's true. In human medicine, the Bulardia has some positive effect on diarrhea in children. But I think we have just one study in horses, and I think there we couldn't find these significant effects which are published, for example, in human studies. And it's not allowed.
That should conclude all of it. This was on probiotics. As you mentioned, the differences are that probiotics are actual bacteria, while prebiotics are sort of food for the hindgut bacteria. What about the prebiotics? Do you have any substances there that you could possibly recommend, or that it's there is some data behind?
I mean, there are some studies about the inulin, which comes, for example, from the Jerusalem artichoke. However, this is a substance which will be fermented by bacteria. But again, I wouldn't really recommend the inulin in horses with diarrhea when they have already a low pH, when acidosis is in the present in the large intestine, because the inulin, for example, is used as a substance by lactobacilli, by of course by all types of bacteria. But again, the main bacterial fermentation product is again the lactate, and so that it can happen that when you put a lot of inulin into the horse, that there's a drop in the hindgut pH. And we know at least that when you really read the paper that sometimes horses develop laminitis, and it could be the mechanism that there's a drop in the pH, and then endotoxins, etc., may play a role. So the inulin, I wouldn't really recommend it for horses with diarrhea. Sometimes I recommend the inulin in horses who suffer from liver diseases or from kidney diseases, because there is some speculation that those bacteria which produce ammonia are reduced, and then it could be a positive effect that the ammonia will not be absorbed through the intestine into the bloodstream, and it may decrease the ammonia load in the liver. But the data are not very clear, but sometimes I use the inulin, but not in horses who suffer from diarrhea or whatever. So the same is with lactulose, which is also a sugar which will be fermented, and it's the same effect that the pH drop in the large intestine, and I don't really recommend it in horses with diarrhea who suffer from acidosis. There are other substances like the psyllium. This is, although for scent evacuation, it's necessary to have really huge amounts of levels of the psyllium. It's more than 1 gram per kilogram body weight, so it means 500 to 600 gram psyllium. But it's also a substance which can be fermented by the bacteria, therefore it could be of interest. But most data about the psyllium we have is the scent evacuation, and then from these study we really know that only in the combination of high dosages, 1 gram per kilogram body weight, in combination with another substance like paraffin oil or like magnesium sulfate, in this combination, it could be recommended to get rid of the sand, but it's just a therapy for the veterinarian to do it after sand colic and do it 3 days, and then you should stop it. But daily dosage of psyllium, let's say 50 to 100 gram, is not very helpful.
Okay, that's interesting, because I think it's pretty common, especially, I mean, I live in an area where there are very sandy soils, and it's quite common that horse owners will give their horses psyllium seed for 4 or 5 weeks in the autumn when the mud is starting to, or when the grass is decreasing and so on. But that doesn't really have an effect, in your opinion, or?
And not in my opinion, because the scientific data show it that when you use very low dosages, that there's no effect on sand evacuation. But just for the acute treatment of a sand colic with a high dosage, and it's not that very easy to get the psyllium through the tube, but you can manage it, and just in combination with, for example, magnesium sulfate, then it works. But it's a medical treatment by a veterinarian, but low dosage doesn't work at all. We have really clear scientific data. And coming back to the forage, we have, there was a comparison by feeding high amounts of forages, that then the sand evacuation is more improved than adding any psyllium into the diet. So again, forage is the word, because it's probably by the volume in the large intestine, then the sand can be evacuated.
Yeah. You really help saving a lot of money for the horse owners.
Yeah, you should spend your money in a good quality forage.
I really like the psyllium conversation as well, because I've treated so many of the sand impactions, and I exactly like you're saying, it's an emergency medication, and giving the horses these 50, 100 grams twice a day is like, and then we've had the advice of feeding one week per month and then 3 weeks off, exactly for not having the bacteria getting used to it and blah, 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 blah. But in reality, I've used it, you know, as a prebiotic for those horses that, but whether the volume is enough, I have no idea. Mm-hmm. But that could be interesting to see the potential of psyllium for, as a prebiotic in those pre-fecal water horses. I'm not sure whether that's going to change it. I haven't seen any studies on using psyllium as a prebiotic. Have you?
It's just by personal observation that a lot of German horse owner that try to feed psyllium when the horse suffer from free fecal water, and actually, I mean, it's with every stuff. So some you find a progress or an improvement, and some horses will not respond to psyllium. So it's not that easy, yeah.
But it could be fun if somebody would set up a proper design study and then see if there's any dosage or, but it's a huge thing.
But again, I forgot to say, I mean, there's one case report, they fed psyllium to the horse and the horse developed a kind of psyllium bezoar in the stomach.
Oh, okay.
I can send you the case report. So if you have always two sides of the medal.
Yeah.
And that is what I convince often the veterinarians. I explain them the data. And finally, I show the slide with the psyllium bezoar in the stomach. I say, maybe it's not to say just, nothing will happen and you can use 20 or 100 gram per day and nothing will happen. But again, the medal has two sides.
Yeah. When we talk about then food for the bacteria or prebiotics, I'm guessing then that the bacterial population that you would actually want to increase are the fiber digesting bacteria.
Yes.
Are there any supplements that can help with that? Because I know there are, and these are for intensive care or when the horse cannot be fed. There are these fiber gels and solutions that you can give to add fiber or to. What's your thoughts on those and? And also in general, what would you give to increase the fiber digestibility?
I mean, the first point is very important. You use it in intensive healthcare in foals when they are not able to consume milk. I mean, the foal in the very early days of life, they more or less consume milk, and as far as I know, there are no fiber at all in milk. So, and we know that it needs a certain time that the microflora in the large intestine needs to be developed in young growing foals, because again, milk has no fiber. So from that, we know that in the early first days, probably the foal is not really dependent on a high fiber diet, because the microflora needs to be developed, and then foals start grazing, etc., small amounts of fiber, and then we have maybe some diarrhea, etc. And from those data, we have that there's the adaptation, it needs up to 6 months. I have no problem if there is some fiber added to the diet. But again, I think it depends really on the age of the foal. But really, in a foal with in the first 2 or 3 days of life, the foal is definitely not dependent on fiber. We have to consider what is in the milk, and then we have to adapt our diet to it. And again, when there is a healthy horse, maybe it's 3 months of age and it's healthy and it can drink milk and consume some grass and some forage, or you have an adult horse which is able to consume, let's say, 12 kilograms of hay, so why do you want to add a supplement with fiber? Of course, you can do it. An interesting fiber source could be the soybean or the fiber from the soybean, the hulls, because it's very well fermented. And the pectins could be of interest. For example, in the sugar beet pulp, the pectins are interesting because they are easily fermented without a really significant drop in the pH in the large cecum. So if, for example, a horse is very thin and it's not able to consume really sufficient amounts of forage, then of course the pectins and the soya bean hulls are really of interest because of their high fermentation potential. But again, we are in a single feed, and but that's really a good point to use at least some more pectins to increase the fiber digestibility in the large intestine. And so for me, these two feedstuff are really of interest. Maybe also the brewer's yeast, but probably there is much more the protein quality of interest. So it's also quite good protein source. But at least there are some cell walls fiber from cell walls of the yeast, which are also easy to digest. So it's also tough for the large intestine. But it depends always on the situation. In a healthy horse, forage is a keyword. But of course, in intensive medicine, so yeah, substances like pectins, etc., they are of course of interest.
So this will be included in horses that, for instance, had a dysbiosis after severe antibiotic treatment, where you have some changes in the hindgut flora and stuff. What would be your best advice to handle horses like this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would combine, for example, the pectins, the sugar beet pulp, with the brewer's yeast, because the brewer's yeast is also of interest for the vitamin B, or as a vitamin B source, because there is maybe some information that when you have a severe dysbiosis or an antibiotic treatment, that probably the fiber digestion is reduced and therefore also the production of the B vitamins. Therefore, it could be of interest to use such a source and to use, for example, the pectins as a very easy fermentable substrate. So that is what I recommend horses who suffer from diarrhea to use this combination, and of course a good forage quality. But yeah, that is a quite good point. But for example, after an episode of diarrhea, I never recommend inuline, for example.
Okay, yeah.
One short comment. So those veterinarians who want to feed now soybean hulls, it's not that easy to get this product as a single feed. But when you look, there are some companies that use the soybean hulls as an ingredient, then it's fine. But it's much easier to get the sugar beet pulp. Theoretically, the soybean hulls are really interesting feedstuff. And I wanted to, I had one horse owner and he was also very interested in the soybean hulls. And I said, okay, if you want to order 3 tons, I can organize it, but I can't organize 100 kilograms. And that is the problem with the soybean hulls in the moment.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Ingrid, for all this very valuable insights. I think there are a lot of confusion, and it's easy to get lost out there because there are so many claims being made. As a veterinarian, I think it's very helpful to have some very solid advice like this. So thank you so much for that.
Tak fordi du lyttede med til Hestedyllerne. Hvis du kan lide det du hører, så læg en anmeldelse i din podcast app og glem ikke at fortælle dine kolleger om podcasten. Vi er snart tilbage med et nyt spændende afsnit af Hestedyllerne.